When the young woman arrived at Lewis Gale Medical Center, it was clear something wasn't right. She was 24 weeks pregnant, far enough along for it to be obvious, not yet ready to give birth. She was bleeding. She was in obvious pain. Dr. John Harding, one of the doctors on call that night, would later recall the desperate fight to save two lives. In a hearing with officials from the Virginia Department of Health about a month later, Harding would recap what happened. An emergency birth. The urgent need to get the infant to a neonatal intensive care unit. A phone call made to a nearby hospital with the nearest NICU in the area. Getting the baby there would be its best chance for survival, he knew. But there was no neonatal intensive care unit at his hospital. Not for lack of trying. Lewis Gale Medical Center had wanted to build a NICU for more than a year, but the effort had been blocked by Virginia's healthcare bureaucracy, which determined there was not a need for a NICU when there was another hospital 6 miles away that had one. On that night, in February of 2012, those 6 miles might as well have been 600. Harding called the other hospital, but the special ambulance used to transport infants wasn't able to get there on time. The mother survived. The baby did not. It took a preventable tragedy before Lewis Gale won its fight with healthcare regulators in Virginia. Today, the hospital has a functioning NICU. Meanwhile, in other places, attempts to improve maternity care are being stymied by a similar set of rules.
My name's Katie Rose Chubb. I'm from Augusta, Georgia. I'm originally from the UK. I am a serial entrepreneur, and my last company was the Augusta Birth Center, which we are still trying to open.
Katie knows all about what it's like to give birth in Georgia. She's done it 3 times.
The state of maternal care in Georgia is one of the worst in the United States.
Or at least it's close to the worst. In 2022, nearly 900 infants died in Georgia. The state's infant mortality rate was the 9th worst in the U.S., with more than 7 deaths for every 1,000 newborns. And things are getting worse. The number of babies who died before their first birthday in the state rose 13% in 2022, according to the CDC. But when Katie says Georgia is one of the worst places in the country to give birth, she's making a qualitative point as much as a quantitative one.
We don't have enough mid-level providers. The amount of women that said, I want to see a nurse midwife because I've seen nurse practitioners and I like their approach. When I went into some of the more economically depressed areas in Augusta, I found that people who were illiterate didn't want to go to the doctor because they're given 15-page documents. They don't know how to sign. The other problems we had were people just felt like the doctors were inaccessible. They didn't listen to them.
For the past few years, Katie has been trying to do something about that. Frustrated by the lack of options for mothers and babies in her corner of the state, Katie planned to open a new birthing center in the city of Augusta. Birth centers are freestanding facilities, meaning they're not part of a hospital, where midwives and other professionals offer pregnancy, birth, and postpartum care. Though they're not for everyone, they've become more popular in recent years as an alternative to hospital births and as a safer option than giving birth at home.
I looked at, after I came home, I looked at other birth centers, how far away they are, what's preventing Augusta from having one. And that just literally led me into, hey, I run businesses, I know business, I can open one. And then we found out about certificate of need process.
But first, she had to convince the state of something that should seem readily apparent. That her birthing center was something Georgia really needed. You're listening to a Reason Magazine podcast series about how the free market could keep Americans healthy and well cared for if only the government didn't get in the way. On today's episode, part 1 of 2, I'm sitting down with an eye surgeon from North Carolina and a young mother from Georgia, Katie Chubb, whom you just met. Both are facing the same dilemma. They've got opportunities to bring needed medical care to their communities, but they've been stymied by a little-known set of regulations, often used by existing providers to block new competition from entering the market. We'll talk to other experts about the history of those laws, the intentions behind them, and the problems they cause for doctors and patients. I'm Eric Boehm, and this is Why We Can't Have Nice Things.
This is the ball of Tiger Woods.
Augusta, Georgia is a place of contrasts.
Oh my goodness.
If you recognize the name of the city, it's probably because you've watched the Masters, one of the world's top golf tournaments, held each April at the Augusta National Golf Club
in Augusta, Georgia. CBS Sports presents the Masters.
Beyond the stately mansions and the exclusive country clubs, there's another side to the city.
It has great areas of great prosperity and areas of great poverty. It has some areas that I've seen poverty that's worse than when I've worked in Romania and India. It has areas that desperately need help, and then it has areas that don't need any more help and are doing just fine. So it's a very diverse community.
When Katie's first child was born, she made an arduous 2-hour drive while in labor from Augusta to Atlanta. And many other parents from the region do the same thing if they're looking for birthing services that the local hospitals don't provide.
The nearest birth center was Atlanta Birth Center, which had an incredible reputation. They're led by a really strong female who's highly educated, Anjali. So I decided I wanted to drive there, and they said they've had multiple mothers drive from Augusta to give birth. I drove all the way there in labor. I went to 42 weeks, but I was still healthy. My son just didn't want to come out.
For expectant mothers who can't or won't make the trip to Atlanta, the options in rural Georgia can be pretty slim. There are 93 rural counties in the state that lack a single hospital with a labor and delivery unit, according to a 2021 study by Mercer University School of Medicine. 84 of those rural counties have no OBGYN care. There are 3 hospitals in Augusta, but that doesn't mean there's not a need for more options. That's especially true for residents who don't feel comfortable in a hospital setting. And more mothers are using birth centers these days. The number of midwifery-led birth centers in the U.S. has more than doubled since 2011, and birth center births have increased by 65% over the same period. Katie's plan was to give the women of Augusta that same choice.
I got with some of my clients. I got with Dr. Mai Bledsoe, who's a family practice MD who has experience in obstetrics, and Kimberly Queen, who's family practice medicine. Nurse practitioner, and the 3 of us got together and said, we could probably open this and it would make a huge difference for Augusta, and it would save a lot of women traveling back and forth to Atlanta or up to South Carolina. We had women going to North Carolina for births, and that's kind of what spurred me on, and just the fact that there's nothing here that offers that same level of care.
This seems like exactly how a functional healthcare market should work. There's an obvious demand for additional maternity care in this part of Georgia, and Katie was using her entrepreneurial skills to fill that need. And this is a good idea. The proliferation of birth centers has been a positive for mothers and babies' health. In a report to Congress last year, a Medicaid commission concluded that birthing centers demonstrated better outcomes for both mother and child, and that they achieved those improved outcomes at an overall lower cost. But then Katie ran into a big problem. Under Georgia law, birthing centers and a lot of other medical facilities need a special type of permission from the state before they can operate. Getting that permission slip, something called a certificate of need, is a complicated and lengthy process.
So we started planning in 2020. 2021 was when we submitted our certificate of need. That was 826 pages, including, I think, over 200 letters of support, which is more than they've ever got for any certificate of need. All of our doctors and nurse practitioners submitted medical licenses, submitted transfer paperwork that they had, what hospitals they worked at, their training programs. We submitted a lot of evidence to prove that we could do this.
The State Department of Health reviewed Katie's application and concluded that there was a need for the services she was offering. In its review, the state said that the proposed birthing center would provide a low-cost, high-quality alternative for the maternal health care in the area. And then the state rejected her application. Okay, so Katie correctly identified the need for more maternal health care in Augusta. She found a place to locate her birthing center, and she lined up the highly skilled medical professionals to staff it. And yet the state still said she couldn't open it. How is this possible? Also, her story is not unusual. Certificate of need laws, or CON laws as they're also called, these things are on the books in most states. And even though the particulars vary a bit from place to place. Before digging more into Katie's situation, I wanted to know more about why these rules exist in the first place. So I called up someone who's spent years researching this strange little niche of American healthcare law.
My name's Matthew Mitchell. I'm a senior research fellow at the Knee Regulatory Research Center at West Virginia University. And I've been studying certificate of need laws for more than a decade now.
Matt, you recently published a paper that reviewed more than 120 different studies of certificate of need laws. So give me the big picture here. What's the deal with these things?
The balance of evidence is pretty strong that PON does not lead to good outcomes, whether those outcomes you're looking in terms of does it reduce spending or cost? Does it increase access? Does it increase quality? Does it increase access or quality for vulnerable populations? And, you know, the overwhelming evidence is no. In fact, for every one study finding a good outcome, there are more than four that find bad outcomes. Most predominantly, it's associated with less access to care, but it's also associated with lower quality care and higher costs.
I also asked Matt to explain where these laws came from in the first place.
Like so much bad policy, they came out of the 1930s. And the very first, you know, examples of them were in transportation industries. Today, you actually still see that. It's common to have a CON requirement for moving companies, of all things. Ambulance companies sometimes have CON requirements that are actually found in transportation statutes rather than healthcare statutes. What makes a CON law a CON law, you know, as opposed to an occupational regulation or something like that, is that it involves a regulator essentially second guessing the provider's belief that their service is needed. And so they are asking whether the service is needed. And, you know, obviously markets actually ask that question. Consumers, you know, providers of a service have to ask that question by asking themselves if they think whatever they are going to provide is going to, you know, be able to, is going to sell. And if it's going to sell in, at a price that justifies its cost, that's kind of what markets do. You know, it's assessing one of the things about that is, you know, right off the bat, they're not asking what's your qualifications, what's your safety record, what are the adequacy of your facilities. Sometimes they might ask that, but for the most part, that's not really the gist. They're really just saying, why do you think this is needed? And in the process, there's just a lot of anti-competitive features that are built into any kind of a regulation that asks that question.
A bunch of states had adopted CON laws by the late 1960s, but the real explosion came after the federal government got involved.
New York was the first state to have a CON law, and it was in 1964. The real impetus, however, happened a decade later when the federal government passed an act called the National Health Planning and Resources Development Act. And that threatened to withhold federal funding from any state that didn't adopt a CON law. And so with that, pretty much all the states adopted CON laws.
The federal mandate was supposed to reduce healthcare costs. The idea was that giving states control over hospitals' capital investments would prevent overinvestment, and it would keep hospitals from having to charge higher prices to make up for unnecessary outlays. Pretty quickly, though, it became obvious that CON laws weren't working as intended. A little more than a decade after the federal mandate took effect, it was repealed. And fittingly, it was a congressman from rural Georgia, J. Roy Rowland, who led the charge in getting rid of them.
By the mid-80s, it was pretty, there had already been a number of studies suggesting CON laws don't work. And so, and this was still kind of the era when Democrats and Republicans agreed that a lot of regulations were anti-competitive. And so you had a Democratic Congress and Republican president come together and get rid of the federal mandate.
Even without that federal mandate, state-level CON laws have persisted for years. And that's in part because they work extremely well for existing hospitals and other special interests in the healthcare industry. Special interests that Katie Chubb was about to confront.
We submitted our application, which was things like our building plan, how much money we had, how we were getting funding. It was the most advanced business plan I've ever done in my life, and it was almost a little bit too intrinsic and too nosy for my liking.
Her application included dozens of letters of support, including some that were written by healthcare workers at the very hospitals that would eventually oppose Katie's plan to open the birth center.
The harder letters to get were from staff at the hospital because they did not want to risk losing their job, and I instructed them, if you feel that you're going to lose your job, don't do this. We had an entire hospital full of staff that really wanted to partner with us. They saw the need. They saw women come in after having disastrous births with nobody attending at home because they felt they had no option. And they knew that a birth center would be a great way to partner with us, to partner and bring this level of maternal mortality down.
So despite all of that, Katie's application could not overcome one detail that effectively leaves hospitals in control of this whole process. Before she could open, Katie needed to get a nearby hospital to sign something called a transfer agreement. Essentially, that's just a document that says a patient can be transferred to the hospital in the event that something goes wrong. None of the hospitals in Augusta would sign one. And that's ultimately the reason why the state denied Katie's application.
We know we're getting denied. But when they denied us, they'd called our lawyer because I'd given birth 2 days earlier. And the lady who was doing her application had the humanity enough to say, hey, I don't think she needs this right now. So she called our lawyer. And during the process, I think she accidentally gave us some tips because she said, oh, you passed on showing community need. You passed on your financing. You passed on showing everybody's credentialed. You didn't make the transfer agreement, but you passed on showing that you have ambulances that are willing to take your patients. That really helped us because that denial showed step by step what we had and that we only missed on one thing, which is where the hospitals used to block us. So in the denial, as much as it was a sad moment, we're not going to give up. And we have all the credentialing and all the right. And you showed that this was needed, but yet you still denied us because you allowed the hospitals as a business to oppose us. So you're saying that a McDonald's can't open next to a Burger King is what you're essentially saying is you can't have two competing businesses in the healthcare market.
We're going to leave Katie for just a moment while she gears up to do battle with the hospitals in Augusta, and we're going to shift our attention about 300 miles northeast to the city of New Bern, North Carolina, where a similar battle has been playing out for years.
My name is Jay Singleton. I'm an ophthalmologist in New Bern, North Carolina. I've been practicing here for over 20 years. I primarily do cataract surgery, some glaucoma surgery, and plastic surgery. Currently, I performed over 40,000 cataract surgeries.
I met Jay at his surgical center. Unlike what happened with Katie Chubb in Georgia, he was allowed to build and open this facility, which is connected to a vision clinic that he also runs. He's even allowed under state law to do some cataract surgeries here, but weirdly, only some.
We are in my pre-op and post-op area of my surgery center that I built about 7 years ago and I'm still not able to use to its full extent. Behind you, if you look back, is the patient waiting room and a small office space. And if you look to your right, this is the surgical corridor that you go into. But, you know, that's kind of it in a nutshell. It is a fully accredited surgery center that is not being utilized to its fullest.
And you obviously do some surgeries here. What's the distinction between what you can do here and what you have to go up to the hospital to do?
That is where it gets really, I'm sure it's kind of strange to you. So most people at the age of 65 switch over to Medicare and use their private insurance as their secondary. Once they do that, they can no longer have surgery here because their primary insurance is Medicare. I have to take them to the surgery center. And since most people with cataracts are over the age of 65, I lose most of my patients to the hospital. People that just have Blue Cross Blue Shield, I can do here, which month to month varies, but basically that's 12 to 15% of my patients.
So it's not that Jay is unqualified to do cataract surgeries in his facility here, and it's not that this place is somehow unsafe. He can legally and safely perform a cataract surgery right here on someone who has private insurance. But if they're enrolled in Medicare, the North Carolina Certificate of Need law says he has to do that exact same surgery at the hospital up the road. Of course, doing surgery at the hospital costs more. And it can be more difficult to schedule.
There are people waiting 9 months for cataract surgery. And by the time I see them, they've had car accidents. You've got to realize there are not a lot of eye surgeons in this area. Then you decrease the patient's access to the very few eye surgeons. You have people waiting forever on a five-minute surgery that could change their life. So access is a huge one.
I'm still a bit confused about this weird distinction that says Jay can do some surgeries here, but not others. So I got in touch with an attorney who's been representing Jay in his ongoing fight against North Carolina's Certificate of Need law.
My name is Josh Windham. I'm an attorney at the Institute for Justice. And for the past 8 years at IJ, I have defended economic liberty in state courts against unreasonable government regulation.
When did you first hear about con laws?
That's a great question. The issue of North Carolina's con law kind of came on my radar because I was doing research into the state's anti-monopoly clause and I sort of fell down the rabbit hole of these issues. When I first heard about con laws, the first term that came to my mind was Soviet. And I don't mean that in kind of a, I don't mean to throw around an insult, right? I don't mean it in that way. It's just that the way these laws work, they're very Soviet style. There's a sort of government board established with these sort of like, you know, pencil pushing, like horn rim glasses wearing bureaucrats in the same room who all think they can kind of come up with the solution to society's problems with math formulas. And that just sort of seems like the kind of government we aren't supposed to have in the United States. So the more you learn about con laws and the more you learn how popular they are all over the country, you're sort of like, how is this possible in America? It just doesn't seem right.
I'm imagining the bureaucrats standing around a giant map of the state and just drawing lines on it and moving stuff around on the map like, okay, we'll put a hospital here, put a surgical center over there, we'll put a rehab center there, and so on. And it turns out that's not really that far off.
Yeah, North Carolina has what's called a state medical facilities plan, which is a very scientific sounding document for what is in reality just a bunch of bureaucrats getting together in a room and deciding in their infinite wisdom whether certain healthcare services are needed or not. And the plan divides the state up into discrete planning areas.
North Carolina has the fourth most restrictive con laws in the country, according to the Mercatus Center. And you can sort of start to see why this is such a pernicious arrangement. If you're unlucky enough to be in an area where the bureaucrats say your services aren't needed, you can't even apply for a con. Contrast that with what's going on in Georgia, where Katie at least had the opportunity to apply and be rejected, and then she could fight the rejection. But that's not even an option for Jay.
He couldn't apply. That's the problem in North Carolina, is that he entered the market in 2004 as an optometrist in New Bern, and he opened an eye clinic, full-service eye clinic, that, you know, as an ophthalmologist, he, you know, can check your vision, he can see if you have diseases and treat you for those. He even built an operating room in his clinic that he would like to use to perform surgeries, because ophthalmologists are board certified to provide eye surgery. And every year for the past 20 years now, the government has told him and everybody else in the area, there's no need for a new operating room.
But wait, it gets even a little bit crazier. If Jay lived in a different part of the state, a different part of North Carolina, he might not need to get a certificate of need at all. Thanks to some reforms that the state legislature adopted a few years ago, some urban and suburban counties in North Carolina will soon be exempt from many con requirements. I think back to what healthcare researcher Matt Mitchell told me about how these laws were originally meant to preserve healthcare in rural areas, to make sure there was access. But now in North Carolina, you've got a situation where con laws are being used to restrict access to care exclusively in rural areas.
Urban is defined as counties with a population of 125,000 or more, and Dr. Singleton's area falls just short of that threshold. And so the kind of crazy result now is that there is unlimited competition under North Carolina law in big urban centers for precisely the thing Dr. Singleton wants to do. If he moved to Wake County or Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, he would be allowed to do this tomorrow. But because he lives in a more rural area, you know, he's forbidden from competing with the hospital 2 miles down the road.
Right. We've now got free competition in Charlotte, but monopolies in the parts of the state that we were trying to help in the first place.
It's really, I use the phrase crazy talk. It is crazy talk. I mean, it's, to put it simply, you have the government saying that less expensive quality healthcare services that patients actually need are not needed. Who is the government to say that to people, right? Shouldn't patients and doctors make those choices? Aren't they the ones who are best suited to determine whether their services are needed? I think the answer to that is yes, and I don't see how the legislature gets off deciding otherwise.
Compared to some other big healthcare issues that get more attention, it might seem like con laws aren't that big of a deal. This might seem like a legal, bureaucratic issue, not a matter of life and death. But it can be. We opened this episode by talking about that tragic incident that happened at Lewis Gale Medical Center in Salem, Virginia, a small city along the spine of the Blue Ridge Mountains. In 2010, administrators at Lewis Gale had applied for a certificate of need to build a new neonatal intensive care unit. In that application, they explained that the growing region had a greater need for neonatal care, and that the number of babies born in the area had doubled in recent years. And the hospital was ready and willing to spend the $3.4 million necessary to build the facility. When the State Department of Health held a hearing on that application in August of 2011, 94 people showed up to speak. Not a single one voiced opposition to the project. The only opposition came in the form of a letter from someone affiliated with Carilion Hospital, which is located in the neighboring city of Roanoke. Carilion already had a neonatal intensive care unit, the only one in Southwest Virginia at that time. Virginia's Department of Health had never before rejected a CON application to build a NICU. And when it was approving a similar proposal from a different hospital in 2007, the department noted that on-site specialty care for infants appears to be becoming the standard of care for hospitals, as safety has improved and technology and expectations have evolved. Nevertheless, the state sided with Carilion and rejected Lewis Gale's application. Then, as you know, tragedy struck. A few months later, Lewis Gale resubmitted its application for a certificate of need to build a NICU. There was another hearing, and again, there was an overwhelming show of support. It was at that hearing that Dr. John Harding talked about the baby that had died because it couldn't be treated at a NICU. At that same hearing, a labor and delivery nurse at Lewis Gale put it more bluntly. The state's denial of Lewis Gale's previous application has robbed us of our ability to provide the best quality care to the people of Southwest Virginia, said Kim Beck. Again, there was just a sole opponent to the project, a vice president at Carilion. She said there was no need for a NICU at Lewis Gale because her hospital had the capacity to serve all the babies born in Southwestern Virginia. And once again, the state denied Lewis Gale's application. Finally, in 2023, a decade later, Lewis Gale opened its neonatal intensive care unit. To do it, the hospital first had to spearhead a legislative effort to change Virginia's certificate of need laws.
Officials at Lewis Gale Medical Center cut the ribbon on a neonatal intensive care unit at the hospital in Salem Tuesday. But Dr. John Harding couldn't help but think about what motivated him to keep fighting through a decade-long state regulatory process. The death of a newborn because the only nearby NICU at the time wasn't available.
And that's been on my heart for many years. And this is going to change that outcome.
Lewis Gale first tried to get a NICU approved by the state in 2011.
In the beginning, it seemed like a no-brainer, you know? We have the money, the desire, everything we need. We just needed that check mark.
It's impossible to know, of course, whether that baby would have survived if Lewis Gale had a NICU in 2012. Even so, I asked Matt Mitchell what the Lewis Gale story says about how con laws work, or more accurately, how they don't.
So I think that's kind of an illustration of, it's easy to think about this as an abstract, academic exercise or as maybe something that has to do with hospital profits or something like that. But it's real lives that we're talking about.
What's going on here? Because, are the regulators just really bad at deciding what need is or where the needs are? Like, are they just failing at their job?
You know, that could be some of it. I think it's probably less, I'm less inclined to blame the regulators as, necessarily bad folks. I suspect they're trying to do their job. I think that the problem is really that it's just sort of baked into the process. So there's a number of things, that make it anti-competitive. So for one, most regulations and most statutes say that a con has to be denied if it can be shown that it will duplicate an existing service. Well, that language of duplication is really what you and I would call competition. So it essentially, guarantees a local monopoly. Another anti-competitive feature, though, that's really prominent is that all but six certificate of need states allow incumbent providers to be a part of the process. So even if they're not sitting on the board, they are allowed to object to a competitor's application. And so they wait that. And now here's where, public choice comes in. The folks that are, most have most at stake here are the would-be competitors, and they're very well organized and they know how to object to a con law, and they're gonna file an objection. Those who have stand to lose, the patients, typically don't even know these rules exist. Providers who are, new entrant providers, they're typically not very well organized politically. So that stacks the deck against competition.
As Matt says, the deck is very much stacked against anyone who wants to enter a healthcare market that's regulated by a certificate of need law. But that's exactly what Katie and Jay are aiming to do.
When I first started the birth center, I interviewed with a very smart man from the Augusta Chronicle called Thomas Colwin. He's been a health reporter for many years. And he said, "This is a game of chess, Katie." He said, "I don't know if you know what you're getting into." And I said, "Oh, good thing for me is I love chess and I love a challenge."
It is a monopoly, and you can't argue that. I'm just hopeful for change, because if I think any other way, I could start to slowly lose faith in the foundations upon which the country's built, because this is a slam dunk.
For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You've been listening to the latest episode of my podcast, Why We Can't Have Nice Things. On next week's episode, we'll follow Katie and Jay as they fight for government permission to serve the healthcare needs of their communities, and they take on the special interests that stand in their way.
They were interested in blocking us at whatever the cost.
And he stood up and stared at me and hit his hands on the table. And he said, we're going to fight you on this.
Can't wait to get to that. Special thanks to my guests today, Katie Chubb and Dr. Jay Singleton. You'll hear more from them next week, of course. Also, Matthew Mitchell and Josh Windham. This topic was just too big, too complicated to squeeze into a single episode. So join us here again next week as we dive into the legal and legislative battles that Katie and Jay are fighting. In the meantime, you can learn more about Josh's work and the Institute for Justice's campaigns against Certificate of Need laws at IJ.org, and check out Matt's latest research paper and all of his work on the history of Certificate of Need laws at Mercatus.org. To learn more about the situation at Lewis Gale Medical Center, you can read my feature story from the April 2017 issue of Reason Magazine. You can find that at reason.com in our archives on the website. Today's episode was written by Eric Boehm and produced by Hunt Beatty. Fact-checking by Anthony Wallace. Our executive editor at Reason is Jim Epstein. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you again next Thursday.